Hi folks, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with news from the Arizona Daily Sun for Thursday, May 15th. I'm Flagstaff Volunteer Reader Joe, and we'll kick it off with our front page articles today, beginning with one by Sun Staff reporter Giselle Ortigan. This is Marshall Magnet Elementary School hosts its 25th annual Suzuki Violin Performance at Heritage Square. In the heart of downtown, teachers, students, parents, and music lovers gathered in Heritage Square as the sound of violins filled the air, bringing Flagstaff together to celebrate the young, talented musicians of Marshall Magnet Elementary School. The cement steps of Heritage Square were filled Thursday, May 8th, with a total of 170 kindergarten, first, and second grade students, creating a sea of Marshall blue t-shirts. The 45-minute performance took the crowd through a brilliant showcase of the musical skills students have worked all year to develop. Janelle Rezor, principal of Marshall Magnet Elementary School, has been a part of the violin program for 18 years after starting as a parent volunteer, and she has been proud of how much the program and performances have evolved over the years. Going into her eighth year now as principal, Rezor said she feels fortunate to have the support of the community to keep such a beloved tradition alive. "There's something to be said about tradition, right?" Rezor said. "To keep something going for 25 years and to take over Heritage Square like this, I mean, we're so fortunate to get the support of the community to showcase this right in the heart of it." As a K-5 Title I Arts and Science Magnet School, and in preparation of this event, Marshall Magnet proudly provides 2 30-minute Suzuki violin lessons each week during the school day for all K-2 students. Each student is assigned their own violin to practice with for the year at little to no cost, making it affordable for all families. This is Marshall Magnet's 25th year since becoming a magnet school, meaning its curriculum emphasizes the integration of the arts and science specifically in order to promote the social and academic development of its students through diverse educational pathways. The violin program is one of 15 unique extracurriculars Marshall Magnet offers. With the partnership of Karen Hallberg, the school has been able to facilitate young violinists and also teach students something new through an applied pedagogy. Hallberg has been with the Magnet School since 2001 and is a coordinator, instructor, and grant writer for the Suzuki String Program. She holds a master's degree with an emphasis in Suzuki pedagogy, a master's degree in counseling and human relations, and a doctorate in educational psychology. Her research has focused on the impact of early instrumental musical instruction on working memory in kindergarten children. Suzuki is a way of teaching the violin that is similar to how people learn a language, Hallberg said. Children learn their language and words through hearing before they learn to read, and so the same thing is done here. The Suzuki method is a musical education approach, reasoning that most people can learn to play an instrument based on language learning frameworks. Students demonstrated the effectiveness of this method throughout the performances. The young violinists were doing a lot of stopping and listening, waiting for their moment to play alongside their classmates. They were intentional and swift with their movements. They were also engaging in refining their fine motor skills, as playing the violin requires multitasking and precision. Through the Suzuki method, Hallberg said, she has seen a significant difference in students' coordination and attention span. "I had a statistically significant change in attention, what they call controlled attention," Hallberg said. "It doesn't mean steering and only attending. It means shifting your focus from one thing to another and coming back. The kids, after 15 hours of Suzuki, all improved in that." Ultimately, students were able to effectively overcome interference from distractions that might more or less divert their attention from the cognitive task and stay focused on the performance because of the Suzuki method. Hallberg wanted to get involved with Suzuki musical education because children are the future. She said research shows during these formative years of their education that it's important to encourage their self-esteem and to push them to take risks, even if they make mistakes. After 25 years, Hallberg will never get tired of the annual Suzuki violin performance, what she calls pure joy. The school is now opening its violin program to third, fourth, and fifth graders to expand the program. According to Resor, though the school has faced challenges after the pandemic, such as funding and finding faculty, it is proud of how much it has been able to do over the years. We are so proud of how we've expanded the Suzuki violin program and keep it going despite COVID-19, Resor said. It's been a beautiful program. Both Resor and Hallberg are already looking forward to next year's performance, as the school is planning to construct a space designated for performing. This will allow for all grade-level performances. For now, they are both proud of this long-time tradition promoting their students' skills in both music and cognitive development. And that was Marshall Magnet Elementary School hosts its 25th annual Suzuki violin performance at Heritage Square. Continuing front page headline news, here's an article by Sun staff reporter Abigail Kessler. Basis Flagstaff Graduate Spotlight. Mason Takeuchi, a star shooting for more. Mason Takeuchi will be graduating as part of Basis Flagstaff's class of 2025 this evening, having explored a range of interests both in and out of the classroom. Takeuchi has been a student at Basis Flagstaff since fourth grade and said he enjoyed both the school's academic rigor and the support from teachers and other students. The class sizes are so small, you can basically talk to your classmates about anything, he said, especially because a lot of you had the same class. It's pretty easy to find someone to go to for help. Takeuchi, who is this year's class valedictorian, said the school's curriculum taught him organization and prioritization. Over time, he said, he realized it's more effective to finish studying and homework assignments before taking a break. Completing research for his senior project in the last third of this school year has also taught him about the process of researching and the skills and effort needed to succeed in an internship. Takeuchi did his senior project with Lowell Observatory, analyzing data on the light emitted by meteors. He'd gone to summer camps at the observatory as an elementary school student, and in high school, he has been volunteering with the camps as a counselor in training. His senior project is titled Stacking Shooting Stars, an analysis of meteor light curve patterns through multiple cameras. Lowell assistant astronomer Nick Moskowitz was Takeuchi's advisor for the project, giving him a data set to analyze for correlations between the different properties of a meteor and its brightness. Takeuchi said this found that velocity does seem to have an impact on the light a meteor produces. The project also introduced complexity as a measurement for meteor's light. This can mean additional math is needed to measure the light curve accurately. Takeuchi found that meteors that aren't part of a meteor shower were more likely to have higher complexity. He said his favorite teacher at Basis has been Andrew Robarge, who taught his history classes both this year and in middle school. He definitely made history something that was super, super exciting and really easy to process and understand how cause and effect really drives all of history, Takeuchi said. He was really enthusiastic, always eager to help, and he's an amazing teacher. Robarge was also Takeuchi's advisor for the Congressional Award. Takeuchi was in the 2024 gold medalist class for the award, which is given based on volunteer work, personal development, and an expedition. Takeuchi learned how to code for this, and throughout his time in high school would frequently spend time on the weekends volunteering with his family and local organizations at the Flagstaff Family Food Center. His expedition was a trip with his Scouting America troop. Takeuchi, an Eagle Scout, helped start Venture Crew 1876 in Flagstaff, a type of scout group for ages 14 to 20, focusing on leadership and activities. In 2023, he was one of four scouts recognized in the Grand Canyon Council's inaugural Scouts of the Year Awards, representing Troop 7031. Though he's aged out of the main scout programs, Takeuchi is still part of the Venture Crew, which is now 3 years old, and last summer completed a rim-to-rim trip across the Grand Canyon. Takeuchi has also spent 3 years on the school's cross-country team and has skied in his own time for about 10 years. After graduation, he plans to study physics at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. "I'm excited," he said, "of moving across the country. Definitely it's going to be different. In some ways, it's going to be the same." He said he was looking forward to participating in outdoor activities around the campus and that he eventually wants to earn a master's degree and PhD. "Right now, I'm planning on getting more into astrophysics, specifically because I'm interested in learning about the movement of celestial bodies and space and how that works," he said. "I feel like there's so much unknown about how space works, and it's really important that we learn more because we might be sending probes or even human missions deeper into space than we ever have before." And that was BASIS Flagstaff Graduate Spotlight, Mason Takeuchi, a star shooting for more. Our next headline news story comes to us from Capital Media Services. This is Arizona still quarreling with other states over Colorado River water cuts. Arizonans are in no danger of losing all their water, but the state's top water officials are warning that unless a deal is reached with other states, cuts in Colorado River water deliveries could lead to Arizonans having to change their lifestyles. Tom Buschatsky said Tuesday there is a stalemate of sorts between Arizona and the lower basin states on one side, and the four upper basin states over who is going to have to absorb anticipated cuts in water deliveries, as there simply is not enough water in the river. Buschatsky said talks continue, but that so far, Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming say they shouldn't have to share in future cuts in river allocation. He said that absent some give by those upper basin states or a federally imposed deal that imposes the lion's share of the cuts on the lower basin states, the loss of so much Colorado River water will be felt. "We're not going to live in a place where you turn on the tap and nothing's coming out," he said. "But what would be likely are lifestyle changes." For example, Buschatsky said that could start with restrictions on residential landscaping. Also, what less fresh water means is greater need to pursue alternate water sources, notably what's colloquially known as toilet to tap, where wastewater is processed to the point it can be put back into the drinking water supply. That too has a price, and not just financially. He said much of that treated sewage is now being used to maintain wildlife habitats and riparian restoration. Buschatsky said Arizonans will need to make some policy choices on exactly how important those areas are. "The big unknown," he said, "will be the impact on the Arizona economy of having less water, which is going to impact everybody. At the heart of what's happening is related to the fact that the water that everyone thought would be available when a deal was first cut in 1922 just isn't there." Buschatsky said Arizona, California, and Nevada believe the upper basin states have to deliver more than 8.3 million acre-feet a year. And an acre-foot is the amount of water that could serve three or four households, depending on use. More to the point, he said, Arizona believes that obligation exists regardless of the flow. And that, said Buzhachki, means forced reductions in what those upper basin states can use. The upper basin states, citing the overall reduced flow, contend they shouldn't have to cut what they use. Any failure to reach an agreement, he said, throws the issue to the federal government. And Buzhachki said that having Trump in the White House could be helpful. He said the Biden administration put together its own alternative report about how the shortage should be handled, one that did not consider proposals submitted by the affected states. And Buzhachki said a request to rescind that report has not happened. But I think the current administration is more willing to tweak alternatives and to talk with us collectively, the seven states, about something different that may be a collaboratively created alternative, he said. And if there is no cooperative deal, if there's no collaborative outcome, I believe the federal government will move forward with whatever alternative they want to analyze, Buzhachki said, and you probably won't like what they analyze. If everything else falls apart, the state does have a contingency plan. Buzhachki has asked state lawmakers to give him $1 million he can set aside to hire lawyers to file suit if that becomes necessary. Governor Katie Hobbs already has given her blessing to the proposals, though the Republican-controlled legislature has yet to approve it. The governor does insist, as does her water chief, that it's only fair that the upper basin states agree to accept some cuts to ensure Arizona is not damaged. Our growing economy is not just important to Arizona, she said. It is important to the nation's economy, to national security, to moving manufacturing back to America. But the governor sidestepped a question about whether, given the limited water supply, a proposed new copper mine at Oak Flat in Pinal County makes sense. The transfer of federal land for the controversial project has been held up because of litigation by Native American tribes over the destruction of the land they consider culturally and spiritually important. But that still leaves the issue of whether the project makes sense, with one estimate saying it would consume 250 billion gallons of water over its lifetime, equal to the annual water needs of a city of 140,000 for 40 years. All of these projects, again, go back to that conversation about the economic growth and the dependence that a clean energy future has on critical mineral mining, on copper mining, she said. It is imperative that we work to find the right balance so that we can continue to build a sector to contribute to our national security and our continued path forward, Hobbs said, and mining is a part of that. Hobbs also said she has no answer to a question of whether the state should be more transparent in disclosing the amount of water used by certain industrial users, including data centers. That would allow for a greater public discussion about whether such development should be priority. But the state does not keep track of how much each uses. That's a good question, not something that I've thought about, the governor said, and certainly something we can look at doing more about. And that was Arizona still quarreling with other states over Colorado River water cuts. That brings us to our final front page headline article. This is from Daily Sun staff, Flagstaff Unified School District, mulling use of old school site. The Flagstaff Unified School District, or FUSD, governing board recently heard information about potential uses for Marshall Elementary School's current site after construction on the new building is complete. The district is in the process of building a new location for Marshall across the street from the current school, on the site that used to house the former Flagstaff Middle School building. The project broke ground last spring and is expected to be ready for students in October 2025. A new use has not yet been planned for the school's current location at 850 North Bonita Street after the move, though FUSD Superintendent Michael Pinka mentioned the possibility of using it for other district needs, community activities, or leasing out the space in the short term. The school building is expected to become vacant in January 2026. FUSD hosted two community meetings facilitated by Phoenix architecture firm Orcutt Wilson about the site in December and January. Between 70 and 80 people participated in the meetings, including students, families, district employees, and local community members. Scott Sawinski, a senior associate at Orcutt Winslow, said during the May 6 board meeting that the first event was designed to encourage as many ideas as possible, while the second narrowed that list based on community preferences. The intention was not to find out what the final solution on that site was going to be, he said. It was just to engage with the community, find out what the sentiment was. Some ideas that came out of that process, he said, were to use Marshall's site for green space, athletics and recreation, culture and community, or education and workforce development. At the end of the second meeting, Sawinski said the conclusion was that Marshall's site was pretty integrated with the nearby Flagstaff High School, FHS. Without knowing what the future of FHS might hold, the overall sentiment was there's no urgency to do anything with the site immediately, he said. It would be a benefit with the site to start to study what the future of Flag High might be, what its needs are, and then take a second assessment to maybe know what those possibilities might be, and then the district can move forward. Pinka added that FUSD has applied to have FHS's campus evaluated by Arizona's School Facilities Oversight Board. The application was accepted during that board's April meeting, with district leaders planning to discuss the timeline later in the week of the FUSD meeting. A third party will be conducting an end-to-useful life evaluation at FHS, likely sometime this summer, to determine whether the district is eligible for state funding for renovation or replacement of the campus. The state board would then decide on funding in the fall, which Pinka said works well with the amount of time FUSD would need to understand the needs at FHS and then make designs, conduct community engagement, and source funding for the project. This process would likely take multiple years, he said. It's really prudent to get those assessments, hold off on doing anything with the Marshall School and site until we have that next piece of information that we can start to continue to work on that master plan, get a set timeline, funding streams, and incorporate in that 6 acres for Marshall, Pinka said. A recording of this meeting is available at vimeo.com/FUSD1. With discussion of the Marshall Elementary site beginning around 40 minutes into the May 6th meeting. And that was FUSD mulling use of old school site. And that wraps up our front page headline stories. So on to see what we can find inside the paper today. Next up today, we have a series of local news briefs provided by the Daily Sun staff. First up there, Flagstaff police arrest 4 more in ongoing online sexting. The Flagstaff Police Department, or FPD, is continuing its online sexting operations from last month, making 4 additional felony arrests on Friday, May 9th, and Saturday, May 10th. The new arrestees are Bill Decker, accused of luring of a minor for sexual exploitation, Aaron J. Hudasek, accused of child sex trafficking and contributing to the delinquency of a minor, Ben Joseph Cheney, accused of child sex trafficking, and Jose Adonis Rodriguez, also accused of child sex trafficking. Bond was set at $125,000 for Decker and $100,000 for the other 3. As of Wednesday, May 14th, Only Decker remained in the custody of the Coconino County Detention Facility, according to jail records. The other three suspects had been released on bond. Under Arizona state law, the crime of luring a minor for sexual exploitation is defined as, quote, offering or soliciting sexual conduct with another person, knowing or having reason to know that the other person is a minor, unquote. It is a Class 3 felony with a typical sentencing range of 5 to 15 years in prison. Child sex trafficking is defined as, quote, engaging in prostitution with a minor, unquote, or otherwise causing, enticing, or permitting a minor to engage in prostitution. Depending on the specifics of a defendant's conduct and the minor's age, child sex trafficking may be classified as a Class 2 felony with a significant presumptive prison sentence or a less severe Class 5 felony with the possibility of probation. FPD publicly confirmed it had been running a sting at the end of March after the Arizona Daily Sun inquired about a cluster of arrests for sexual offenses, including prostitution, sex trafficking, and luring. Those arrests were based on messages sent by the suspects to detectives posing as minors on websites and social media platforms. Flagstaff Police Detective Bethany Hyde said in an interview at that time, "The latest arrests were based on similar evidence and tactics," the department confirmed this week. The department named 10 suspects from the earlier phase of the operation in a press release and social media post on April 2nd. As the Arizona Daily Sun reported last week, criminal proceedings are active against 8, including Dave Zorn, who was a prominent radio host in Flagstaff, while one case has been stayed and one suspect has not formally been charged yet in Coconino County Superior Court. And that was Flagstaff Police arrest 4 more in ongoing online sexting. Next brief, Coconino National Forest will manage lightning strike fire near Clint's Well, smoke expected. The Coconino National Forest announced Tuesday that it will allow a lightning-caused fire in the Mogollon Rim Ranger District to burn under controlled conditions for the purpose of fuel reduction. The blind fire is located approximately 10 miles north of Clint's Well and 3 miles east of Lake Mary Road. As of Tuesday, May 13th, the fire was approximately 12 acres in size. Fire managers ultimately hope to treat around 5,000 acres of forest in the area through firing operations, that is, deliberately burning vegetation between an established fire break and an active fire between Wednesday, May 14th, and Saturday, May 17th. Significant smoke is anticipated around Lake Mary Road near Happy Jack. Smoke is likely to settle in low-lying areas in the evenings and may be visible from Interstate 40, Flagstaff, Winslow, and Holbrook. No road or trail closures are planned in the area of the blind fire, but drivers should slow down near firefighters or when smoke is present. According to the U.S. Forest Service, fuel reduction through techniques like thinning or managed fire creates a fire-resilient ecosystem that protects communities, private property, roadways, and timber stands from catastrophic damage. Management of lightning-caused fires for fuel reduction is a common practice on Forest Service lands. The area around Flagstaff was under a wind advisory and red flag warning from the National Weather Service on Tuesday, with sustained 30-mile-per-hour winds and gusts up to 60 miles per hour, but forecasts call for a significant decrease in winds by Wednesday morning. The Coconino National Forest has a dedicated smoke complaint line for people who would like to speak with fire management leadership about smoke impacts. 928-226-4608. Next brief, Flagstaff Pine Needle Pickup moves to Rock Ridge Estates, Ridgecrest, and Anasazi Ridge this weekend, or this week. The City of Flagstaff's Pine Needle Pickup Initiative, which began last month, will expand to additional neighborhoods starting Friday, May 16th. Roll-off dumpsters will be placed in the Rock Ridge Estates, Ridgecrest, and Anasazi Ridge neighborhoods from May 16th through May 23rd. The dumpsters will be located at or near four intersections: Beale Road and McMillan Road, Beale Road and Rock Ridge Road, Kittredge Road and Tolchaco Road, and Hereford Drive and Mead Lane. The dumpsters will move to the Linwood and Cheshire neighborhoods from June 2nd through June 9th, then to Country Club Estates from June 16th through June 23rd. Finally, the dumpsters will be located in Boulder Point from June 30th to July 7th. The dumpsters are part of a pilot program to provide residents with an opportunity to remove organic materials from their yards and reduce the risk of wildfire danger. All city residents may dispose of pine needles in the dumpsters, regardless of their specific location. No other trash or non-organic materials should be placed in the dumpsters. Noah Baker of the Flagstaff Fire Department's Wildland Fire Management Division told the City Council on Tuesday, May 6th, that the previous pickup in University Heights was successful, with dumpsters repeatedly filled to capacity. "The community had a need there, and we didn't get all of it, but we got a big portion of it," Baker said. "I want to thank all our partners and our residents for supporting us through this. It's been a challenge, but it's been a worthwhile challenge, and we're seeing the fruits of our labors there." In addition to the launch of the city's dumpster collection pilot program, Coconino County's Willard Springs Green Waste Site opened ahead of schedule this year. All county residents can drop off organic waste, including pine needles, free of charge on Fridays and Saturdays. The Flagstaff Fire Department recommends that residents remove excess pine needles from their yards and areas near their homes to lower the risk of wildfire danger. Residents are also encouraged to review the department's Wildland Fire Action Guide to prepare for the coming summer months. The guide is available at flagstaff.az.gov/wildfireaction. We're at about the midway point here, so it's time for me to remind you that you're listening to the Arizona Daily Sun from the Flagstaff studios of Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds programming is directed to those who cannot use print material due to a disability. Listen to our live streams and learn how you can support us at the website sunsounds.org. Or you can also get our stream and on-demand programs with the new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android devices. Continuing with local news briefs, this is Open House to Celebrate 75th Anniversary of Williams Health Clinic. North Country Healthcare, or NCHC, and the Williams Hospital District will be holding an open house Friday for the 75th anniversary of the medical clinic and urgent care center in Williams. The event will be held at the medical clinic, 300 South 6th Street in Williams, from 10 to 11:30 a.m. on May 16th. The public is invited to meet clinic staff and hospital district board members and tour the clinic. The clinic first opened as the 20-bed Williams Hospital in 1950. The Williams Hospital District then purchased the hospital from the city in 1974, and NCHC took over management in 2011. The clinic moved into its current facility in 2020, which is 20,000 square feet, with 5 exam rooms for urgent care, 12 for primary care, 3 dental stations, a physical therapy area, and X-ray and lab services. It now serves as the principal primary and urgent care clinic in Williams, according to NCHC's announcement. Urgent care services are available at the clinic 7 days a week from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. "This clinic is a critical part of the Williams and Williams area communities," said Williams Hospital District President Francis Mazza adding that the services offered by the clinic allow residents to access care without driving to Flagstaff. Clinic manager Sherry Milton said she was honored to be taking the role. "I'm proud to be part of a dedicated team that provides critical health care services to this incredible community," she said. And that was Open House to Celebrate 75th Anniversary of Williams Health Clinic. Continuing with local news, here's an article by Sun Staff reporter Abigail Kessler. Flagstaff Unified School District listed as out of compliance by ADE. Change comes after district retracted Title VI assurance form. According to an update in a recent board meeting, Flagstaff Unified School District, or FUSD, has been listed as out of compliance with Title VI of the Civil Rights Act following its retraction of an assurance document in response to federal court rulings. FUSD was among 24 public and charter districts on this list, which is posted on the Arizona Department of Education's, or ADE, website. FUSD is the only one on the list from Coconino County. Another list of Arizona schools considered in compliance on the same webpage has more than 550 districts. This includes several in Coconino County, such as Basis, Flagstaff, Flagstaff Arts and Leadership Academy, Flagstaff Junior Academy, Flagstaff Montessori, Mountain School, Northland Preparatory Academy, the Page Unified School District, the Coconino County Accommodation School District, and the Coconino County School Superintendent. According to ADE's website, whether a school is listed as in or out of compliance with federal civil rights law is based on whether they submitted certification of their compliance. Those that refuse to certify or fail to respond by April 24th are listed as out of compliance. During FUSD's May 6th board meeting, District Superintendent Michael Pinka discussed the topic as part of an update on the district's Title VI certification document. "We as a school district raised our really valid objections to having to sign that form," he said of the initial authorization. "We felt that the requirement was very vague in definition and that the objections that we voiced were really validated by federal courts." He added, "In my opinion as superintendent, us not submitting that form does not equate to us violating Title VI, and we are aware that ADE has listed us as being out of compliance. We respectfully disagree with that, and we are going to continue our commitment to practices, policies, procedures that benefit all of our students. We maintain our compliance with Title VI and other federal or state law." According to Pinka, FUSD's decision has not led to any impacts on district funding. FUSD is currently submitting grant applications for federal funding through ADE, and according to Pinka, it has not seen holds, freezes, or denial of applications as a result of the certification form so far. During the previous meeting, on April 22nd, FUSD's governing board had voted to authorize Pinka to sign and submit a document to ADE attesting that FUSD is in compliance with Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. ADE sent this form to all school districts and charter schools in Arizona in response to a requirement sent by the U.S. Department of Education to each state education agency on April 3rd. The deadline for school districts to sign and submit this form was April 24th, 2 days after the FUSD meeting that discussed authorization. Pinka's update at the following board meeting, held May 6th, gave an overview of what happened with this document in the following 2 weeks. Two federal courts issued orders stopping the U.S. Department of Education and those acting with it from implementing this certification, among other items, on the April 24th deadline. A frequently asked questions document from the Department of Education, linked on the ADA website, references these orders and says it will not take any enforcement action or otherwise implement the February 28, 2025, Dear Colleague letter associated frequently asked questions, the end DEI portal, or the certification requirement until further notice. FUSD's agenda for this meeting said the Department of Education informed the state education agencies of this on April 28th. In response to the ruling, PINCA consulted with the district attorney and decided to retract the Title VI certification for FUSD, which had already been submitted. We felt like that action was really consistent with the board's direction on April 22nd that said, authorize me to sign and submit it, subject to any court order affecting that part, Pinka said. He added that he informed the board members of this decision and continued updating them on developments. FUSD was then included on ADE's list of schools not in compliance with federal civil rights law. The district is not out of compliance with Title VI because it retracted the certification form, according to the item in the FUSD meeting agenda. A recording of that meeting is available at vimeo.com/FUSD1, and that's the number one, with this item beginning about an hour and a half into the May 6th meeting. And that was FUSD listed as out of compliance by ADE. Next up today, we have the latest installment in the Spotlight on Climate feature. This was written by Erica Hinkst-Zahir and C. Lauren Buck, and it's titled Spotlight on Climate, The Fate of Flagstaff's Purple Martins is Global. As May unfurls across northern Arizona, the symphony of spring grows richer each day. The ponderosa forest awakens with the scent of warming earth and the chorus of returning songbirds. Among these avian travelers, the beautiful purple martin makes its annual appearance, bringing its distinctive aerial acrobatics and cheerful chirps to our mountain community. The purple martins that grace our northern Arizona skies belong to a particular subspecies, Progne subis arboricola, the western purple martin. Unlike their eastern cousins who readily occupy human-made birdhouses, our western variant stubbornly maintains its wild independence, preferring natural cavities and standing dead trees within our forests. This nesting preference makes them more elusive to human observers and potentially more vulnerable to habitat changes. The increasingly severe wildfires that threaten our forests each summer pose a particular risk, as do development projects that remove standing dead trees these birds depend on for nesting. As Flagstaff and surrounding communities expand, each ponderosa snag lost represents one fewer potential home for these remarkable birds. Each spring, these iridescent flyers complete an extraordinary journey from their wintering grounds in South America back to their breeding territories across North America. Yet where exactly they spend their non-breeding season and what challenges they face during this period remains partially shrouded in mystery, a mystery that our collaborative team is addressing using biologging to continuously track purple martins across their epic annual migration. This knowledge gap becomes particularly concerning when we consider the steep population decline of this species, a 37% drop over the past five decades. The purple martin's decline is not an isolated case. North America has lost nearly 3 billion birds since 1970, representing a staggering 29% reduction in total bird abundance. Aerial insectivores like purple martins have been hit especially hard, with 73% of these species showing significant population losses. Some bird species have already vanished forever, and others teeter on the brink of extinction. Each lost species represents not only a diminished natural heritage, but also the unraveling of complex ecological relationships built over millennia. The planetary crisis facing wildlife today has many dimensions, with climate change often taking center stage. Warming temperatures and shifting precipitation patterns alter habitats and food sources, and these effects are further compounded by pollutants and toxins we release. 6 decades after Rachel Carson sounded the alarm about pesticides in Silent Spring, chemical contaminants continue to permeate our environment, often with severe consequences. For the past decade, our research team at NAU and global colleagues have been investigating how environmental contaminants in the Amazon basin and Atlantic forest of Brazil affect the biology of purple martins. Our data shows that mercury contamination, largely derived from illegal gold mining operations and large numbers of new dams, is finding its way into these birds' bodies. Among the many toxic effects of mercury, it affects the birds' ability to deposit fat reserves crucial for their epic migrations, potentially compromising their survival. These findings point out that purple martins serve as modern-day canaries in the coal mine, sensitive indicators of environmental health that warn us about toxins we ourselves may be experiencing. While these birds encounter mercury a hemisphere away, they must face the challenges of climate change and pollutants along their whole migration path. Once they reach our drying Flagstaff forests, one additional source of mercury is our many years of burning coal. By protecting habitat and reducing contaminants for these birds, we simultaneously protect human health. Their plight gives us an opportunity to recognize pollution at its source and develop more sustainable approaches to resource extraction, energy production, and land management. For our western purple martins that visit Arizona, there are significant knowledge gaps about migration timing, routes, and non-breeding habitats. If you spot a purple martin in northern Arizona, take a moment to appreciate not only its beauty, but also its resilience in the face of environmental challenges spanning national boundaries, continents, and hemispheres. Consider documenting your sighting on a citizen science platform like iNaturalist or eBird. Your observation could contribute to conservation efforts that ensure future generations will continue to experience the joy of purple martins returning each spring. For more information about purple martins, visit www.purplemartin.org. And here's some information about the authors of that article. Dr. Erica Hengst-Zahir is the director of the Biological Museum Butantan Institute in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And Dr. C. Lauren Buck is with the Laboratory of Endocrinology and Physiology at Northern Arizona University and the Department of Ecology, University of Sao Paulo, Brazil. And they are affiliated with the Northern Arizona Climate Change Alliance. And more information about them can be found at www.nazcca.org. And again, that was the latest installment in the Spotlight on Climate feature. The fate of Flagstaff's purple martins is global. Here's an article that might be of interest to our local university community and associated citizens. This is from Capital Media Services. Hobbs signs bill making encampments illegal on university grounds. It's going to become a state crime for protesters and others to set up encampments at state universities, despite some concerns the measure is unnecessary. Governor Katie Hobbs penned her approval Wednesday to legislation that will require school administrators to direct those involved to immediately dismantle the encampment and vacate the campus. And those who do not comply would be subject to arrest on charges of trespassing. Hobbs did not explain her decision, and there was no immediate response from her press aide. The governor's signature came after both bipartisan support and bipartisan opposition to the proposal by Representative Alma Hernandez, Democrat, Tucson. She said she introduced the measure in the wake of pro-Palestinian protests last year, not just the ones that got national attention, like at Columbia University, but also what happened at both the University of Arizona and Arizona State University. She said that Jewish students felt harassed and were forced to take alternate routes through campus. The Arizona incidents were broken up by police by use of tear gas and pepper balls. The Arizona incidents were broken up by police by use of tear gas, and pepper balls had to be used on the Tucson campus. Despite that, no one from either university or the Arizona Board of Regents signed in favor of the legislation or testified that they supported or needed the change in law. During Senate debate last month, Hernandez got support from lawmakers such as Senator John Kavanaugh. These people are taking public university land and appropriating it, seizing it for themselves so other people can't use it, the Fountain Hills Republican said during discussion of the measure. Kavanaugh also said there have been cases elsewhere where anti-Semitic groups are intimidating Jewish students and removing their right to free movement around the campus. Others, including Senator Lauren Kuby, however, questioned the need for the restrictions. These spaces are long-standing spaces for public discourse, academic inquiry, and political dissent, said the Tempe Democrat. Public education has to remain a robust space for dialogue, not a testing ground for censorship and retaliation. There's also the fact that already existing state law appears to give universities and community colleges the power to limit such demonstrations. It spells out that the schools can impose reasonable viewpoint and content-neutral restrictions on time, place, and manner of expression that are necessary to achieve a compelling institutional interest. Aside from making these encampments a crime, the legislation also requires disciplinary action must be taken against students who refuse to leave. Representative Anna Abadia questioned the wisdom of such legislation. As an activist at heart, this is not a good bill for those of us who are activists and do go out and protest, the Phoenix Democrat said when she voted against the plan in the House. Encampments are a form of sit-ins, she said, and sit-ins have a long history, particularly in the Chicano culture. Phoenix Democrat Quanta Cruz said she fears how the proposal could be used to quash other protests. There are young people who are not trying to intimidate other people, who are not trying to provide a fearful environment, she said. And Cruz said it would be one thing if the legislation was needed to give police more power to deal with those who intimidate others. This, she said, is overly broad. I feel like it could be weaponized against different groups that are not intending to harm other students and are just trying to exercise their First Amendment rights, Cruz said. Foes also had a technical concern. As approved, the new law bans not just any overnight temporary shelters or tents, but also makes it illegal for these items to remain for a prolonged period of time. Senator Annalise Ortiz, Democrat from Phoenix, called that unconstitutionally vague, saying it could apply not just to protesters' tents, but even to sunshades set up by civic groups. That language caught the attention of Representative Alexander Kolodin. What that would include, said the Scottsdale Republican, is a shade and table set up by a conservative group like Turning Point USA, while it is seeking to register voters on the campus. Ditto, Kolodin said, of pro-life organizations when they're handing out literature. And he made no secret of his belief that enforcement will end up being based on who is effective. Let's not fool ourselves about who runs these universities, Kolodin said. Is this bill really going to be used against Students for Justice in Palestine? Probably not, he said. It is going to get used against Turning Point and pro-life. Is it, is Is it going to get used against Turning Point and pro-life organizations? Far more likely. During debate, Hernandez defended the scope of the bill. She said Students Against Apartheid, which set up encampments a year ago at the University of Arizona, refused to leave, presenting the schools with a ridiculous list of demands, such as divesting from certain companies profiting from the war between Israel and Hamas, halting surveillance of student organizers, publicly condemning Israel's genocidal campaign, quote unquote, and defunding the U of A police department. These people had no intention of leaving, she said. And that was Hobbs signs bill making encampments illegal on university grounds. We'll wrap up here with our sole obituary for today. This is for Marcus Kahn Minster. February 12th, 2005 to May 4th, 2025. Marcus Kahn Minster, 20, of Flagstaff, Arizona, died in a single car accident on May 4th, 2025, south of Munns Park while driving home. He was born in Louisville, Kentucky, but spent his life in Arizona with his parents, Cynthia Kahn and Matthew Minister, and his sister, Marissa Kahn Minister. Marcus came into our lives as a chunky baby with an engaging smile, and that smile and quick chuckle was a defining trait his entire life. Early on, he was shy, turning away from cameras, but soon his enormous talents drew him into the spotlight, though he always remained humble. He had a special gift for music, able to remember and repeat melodies he had only heard once. He could play any instrument he picked up and especially loved percussion. He became well known for singing the national anthem at sporting events as a young child, both in Flagstaff and at Arizona Diamondbacks games starting in 2016. He was also featured in numerous Theater Kids productions, including The Wizard of Oz as the Cowardly Lion, Alice in Wonderland, Fiddler on the Roof as the Fiddler, and Newsies. Marcus also loved sports, both playing them and following them. He enjoyed swimming, playing golf, and hockey. At the time of his death, he worked for Jay Lively Ice Rink as a rink guard and scorekeeper for Flagstaff ice hockey games. He loved being on the ice. Marcus was surrounded by a large circle of family and friends who loved and admired him. We will never forget the many gifts he brought to our lives. Donations can be made in his honor to the NAU Foundation. Choose My Gift is a Tribute, Memory of Someone Special, Marcus Kahn Minister, and condolences may be shared with the family at NorvellOwensMortuary.com. That was an obituary for Marcus Kahn Minister. And that's all the time we have today. You've been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with news from the Arizona Daily Sun. I'm volunteer reader Joe. Thanks for listening, and I will catch you next time. Bye.